Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, October 10th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. As ever, we invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. Noah Rothman continues to be on vacation. So with me in studio, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
So, Donald Trump Sunday night announced that we were withdrawing our protection from on the border between Syria and Turkey for the Kurds who have been fighting with us in the war on ISIS in and the essentially the implicit war against Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and that this cork, one might consider this sort of this cordon of about 100 people who were there essentially to prevent the Turks from going after the Kurds who were holding dangerous ISIS fighters in a prison, that we were no longer going to function in this fashion, withdrawing our haven of protection from the Kurds, whom the Turks hate and wish to crush. And so we did that Sunday night out of nowhere, and by Tuesday or Wednesday morning, the Turks started going after the Kurds, which we objected to. It was nice to know that we issued a strong, in the name of the president, we issued a strong statement of condemnation of the Turkish action that he had basically triggered by this weird agreement with Recep Erdogan on this phone call on Sunday night. So,
and people more powerful than us objected to it.
Well, everybody seems to object to it. So first off, I think before we go into our heated objections, I am delighted to see people crying crocodile tears over the Kurds, who have never once even uttered the word Kurd in the last 20 years, or thought that there was any reason for anybody to concern themselves with the Kurds. That has been a small number of people on the right and on the neoconservative right who have concerned themselves with the condition, fate, and cooperative alliance that we have with the Kurds,
and in fact, that
hasn't included the Obama people, who are even now decrying this horrible betrayal.
No, and in fact, we were long mocked for doing that. Like, it was part of our sort of fantasy democracy promotion, obsession with the Kurds.
Yeah. So we should get that. So we got that out of the way, because I'm not going to sit here and let the Pod Save America people act like they gave a crap about the Kurds until it was politically expedient for them to do so. Having completed that act of separation, everybody who says that what's going on here is an outrage is correct. It's an outrage. And we should probably try to delineate why it's an outrage. Abe, you've been a sort of a student of the Kurdish American relationship, or an amateur student, or whatever you want to call it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I dealt more closely with the Kurds in Iraq, as opposed to this group. But there are some similarities, and there are reasons to support both. It's funny, actually, that you say that, because one of the things that stands out is that when I was in, I guess, Erbil in like 2010, and I was talking to someone very prominent among the Iraqi Kurdish leadership at the time, who said to me, "I don't trust governments, I don't trust countries, I trust people." And their point was that they trusted George W. Bush and they didn't trust Obama. And I remember at the time having felt like I wish I could have said, "You can trust the U.S. As a whole." and over time. But here we are once again. I couldn't have said it then when Obama was in office, and obviously I can't say it now. And it's a terrible disgrace. The Kurds have been a long suffering minority in the Middle East. I think the sort of the largest stateless nation in the world. They have been, on the whole, allies of the U.S. and sympathetic toward Israel, because they often see Israel as a model for a thriving minority state, the only one in the Middle East. And they have made one hell of a democratic project get going in northern Iraq, and they have a long history of being spurned by convenient allies, temporary allies.
Well, and the reports that we're getting from the troops on the ground there are just, it's horrifying. I mean, they've had to go to these people who they've been fighting alongside for years and say, basically, I'm sorry. Like, this, it is a betrayal. Betrayal is the word that we should all be using. We've betrayed an important ally, our only ally against ISIS in Syria. And it's shameful. It's just shameful.
I mean, you know, so we have this weird thing where Trump makes this speech the other day, or says this thing about how terrible it is to what happens when a soldier killed in action is sent back to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, and how the families grieve when they see the coffins, and it's so terrible, and this is what he's trying to prevent. And Laura Ingraham and others saying, you know, like, just remember every soldier is a member of a family and all of that, and all of this is true, and it's very important that we heed these sorts of things, and also point out that everybody in Syria, every American in Syria kind of wants to be in Syria. These are people who, in almost every case, I believe, are people who have redeployed, who have chosen to re-up, and who are believers. Trump may not be a believer in the mission, but that doesn't mean that people in the military aren't believers in the post 9/11 mission, and also that these are Americans who are proud to be attempting to prevent genocides and in the Middle East, and do not feel that it is some horrible, dangerous sacrifice for them to be serving there. If they did, they could have not re-upped. We have a volunteer military. This is using the language of how to treat the military when people were being drafted by the hundreds of thousands into the military is itself an act of intellectual laziness and at most sophistry, because saying you're doing this to protect the troops is a false understanding of what it is that motivates people to go into the military in a volunteer situation in the first place and to stay in it, either as a career or as a mission. And so, you know, it infantilizes them. And these are people that we should be treating as pretty much the only adults in their generations because they've made very, very difficult, they made hard choices to do something very difficult for an overarching purpose, for country, for freedom, to protect suffering peoples, whatever. These are noble missions, and we treat them like somehow they are children that Trump, you know, chooses now to protect by making them stand there until they can be redeployed, watching as the mission that they have been on for the last couple of years goes literally up in smoke, and where the people that they have been working side by side with are now at risk of being murdered, or, you know, killed by the Turks.
And it really makes no sense to me from a strategic political standpoint, if you're Trump, to do this now, right? Because he's just thrown a grenade on the table in his relationships with a lot of the Republican leadership that he needs to back him during impeachment proceeding. So it's a very strange kind of explosive moment to choose to do this. And I know, isn't Erdogan coming to Washington pretty soon in a few weeks? I think he's scheduled to come. So that'll be interesting public displays.
We'll see if that happens. I mean, that's, yeah. Last time he came, you may remember, the Turks had literally had people beating people Americans up outside.
Yes, on our sidewalks, on public streets.
Didn't do anything. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. I would say that there is, slightly fiendish quality to what you just mentioned about the Republican leadership in the Senate. There is a way in which this is useful for Trump and the Republicans in the Senate and in the House in relation to impeachment, which is they can say, look, I'm not with Trump on everything. I mean, I'm very critical of what happened in Syria. I mean, that is just beyond the pale in every possible way. So don't say that I just stand with Trump on all things. But on this impeachment thing, that's just a bridge too far. So there is that, it's if you play it out politically, there is some merit even to him in the idea that maybe people can use this as a wedge to support him against impeachment and removal.
But it could also be kind of true. I mean, you could,
as course.
A Republican,
you
could disagree with them strongly on this and still not think that the impeachment is viable.
And we also need to put on the record how absolutely bizarre and ridiculous Trump's statement was about one of the reasons we can't no longer continue to support the Kurds is that they weren't with us at Normandy. So I mean, the bizarre level of his own descriptions and justifications for this change in policy are it's like. He's kind of behaving like a deranged toddler. Well, I mean,
you want even more deranged. So somebody located the source of this peculiar idea coming out of his mouth, and it was a column by Kurt Schliester. I don't know where, town hall or, I don't know, but in which he said, let's face it, the Kurds weren't with us in Normandy. Who exactly was with us in Normandy except for the British? In Normandy? It's not like there was there were 58 nations involved in Omaha Beach, but the Kurds weren't one of them.
At least it's not a lie.
Yeah, no. As far as one can tell, one of the things the Kurds did was they were with us in unpopular battles rather than popular ones.
Right,
so
exactly
that really makes them terrible allies.
Yeah, no. And this is also one of the things like that's so depressing about this president when he gets on a roll is so there's now like there's nothing but nonsense coming out of his Twitter. It's at a very serious moment, and there's it also is deranged. He had another deranged tweet saying that in his infinite wisdom and unparalleled judgment, he would destroy
Turkey's economy if it stepped out of line.
But what step? It's already underway. It's doing exactly the thing that the U.S. policy did not want it to do. So what is he talking about?
It's also the whole thing. I mean, in every way, shape, or form, you sort of turn this around. It makes no sense because, of course, Turkey is nominally, not just nominally, but is technically a signed ally of the United States. It's a member of NATO and a part of the, Western alliance. Erdogan, of course, has been testing the limits of what it means to be an American ally for the last, 12 years that he's been in power. And in this case, he's calling Trump as an ally, and he did exactly what, I think we said this on Monday, but he did exactly what Putin did to Obama in Syria in 2013, which is he said, I'll handle this. Mm-hmm. Let me take this cup from your lips. I really got to do something about these Kurds. They're terrorists, the PKK. They come into my country and kill people. Mm-hmm. And, you hate terrorists. I hate terrorists. You don't want to be I don't want you in the Middle East. You don't want to be in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Let me take this. And he's like, okay, great.
Well, and that actually, that speaks to your earlier point about the kind of crocodile tears of former Obama officials, one of whom was on NPR this morning saying, oh, the poor Kurds, this is terrible. Trump is terrible. But of course, the Kurds guarding all these ISIS soldiers in makeshift prisons is not the answer. As much as we hate Assad, we really need to let Syria take care of this problem. It was a really fascinating moral contortion, especially that early in the morning.
Yeah, by the way, you know, sometime around 2014 or so, I just had read this recently, the Kurds in Syria were talking about trying to establish another independent region, and Joe Biden came down on them very strongly because of out of deference to Turkey, saying the U.S., he said in no uncertain terms, the U.S. will pull its support for Kurdish fighters in Syria if it seeks to organize itself in that way, because the Turks do not want that.
Can I make another point about the tiny force in Syria that we have deactivated in some fashion or other? In a world in which the president abhors ideological crusades and, you know, things like that, and thinks they're terrible, little patchwork solutions to ongoing problems are the answer. Like that, this is the sort of thing that a Trumpian foreign policy should include. So it's, yeah, we got some guys on the border preventing a Holocaust. You know, really, it doesn't cost us much, and they're really not at risk. And obviously, anybody, you know, sort of goes at them, you know, will go at the people who go at them. This is a low cost, high delivery solution that he has just, you know, abandoned. And what in the absence of a, not a crusade, but what in the absence of an ideologically consistent foreign policy are we going to have in the name of sort of tiny victories? Like, yeah, we got some ISIS fighters in a prison. They're being guarded by the Kurds, and we're guarding the Kurds to keep the Turks from killing the Kurds. It is, you know, it is the definition of a modest application of American power.
That's right. It's not this regime change goal. It's not about getting rid of Assad. It is this low ambition. The least we could do to keep the most serious aspect of a situation under control. Yeah.
So and Trump is very susceptible to these to these gimmicky offers. You know, he's like a guy. He gets a phone call from, you know, a telemarketer, and he actually listens.
It's the Groupon approach to foreign policy.
Right, instead of hanging up, you know? It's like someone says, is this Donald Trump? I'm from the Turkish Association of Freedom Fighters. Can I talk to you a little bit about, you know, it's got that quality. It's like, okay, why not? I got nothing else to do. I'll listen to you. As opposed to saying, you know what, Recep, let me get some of my guys on the phone so that we can all, you know, hear your offer and then discuss it, you know, maybe, you know, we can get back to you. Like, you know, give me like 48 hours. I'll get back to you. Now it's conceivable. I mean, we don't really know what was on that phone call, and we never will, since I assume it's in box number two that where the transcripts are not available. But, you know, I mean, Erdogan could have said, look, the time is now. I got to go in against the Kurds right now. So, and I'm sorry, I mean, I don't want to put any American, you know, it's like you've got some nice Americans there, pity if something were to happen to them. Mm. I mean, it is conceivable that it got tough as opposed to nice. I don't know.
But
who knows?
But at that point, a different president would get tough in response.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I don't know that happened.
Right.
I'm only saying that we don't know what triggered his acceptance of the offer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is precisely, this is where this easy, boy, you know, Trump just showed that, you know, neocon foreign policy was hollow and nobody likes it and blah, 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 blah. Well, okay, so let's just say for the sake of argument that the Kurds, you know, basically have to run. And they, you know, they run away, and the prison doors are opened, and these ISIS fighters escape from the prison and start reconstituting themselves in some fashion or other. And then, you know, they kill a lot of people. I don't think Americans will like to hear that.
Well, so in that sense, it's an echo of something else the Obama administration did in Iraq, which is to pull out in, I don't know, 2010 or 2011 or so.
The end of 2010.
Where Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been rounded up and were imprisoned, and they broke free and reconstituted and as ISIS became ISIS and came across the border. It was all done in the name of, we are winding this down, we are ending this war, we no longer need to be there.
Well, we couldn't get a status of forces agreement because it was just the Iraqis were just being very difficult and recalcitrant and about signing the agreement that we needed them to sign. So we just had to leave.
A globally destabilizing mistake.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that you know, contributed to the Syrian conflict.
Which led to the migrant crisis in Europe and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if you're Trump, you might look at this as, you know, this created the political opportunity of a lifetime. Because maybe without the migrant crisis in Europe, he wouldn't have been elected in 2016.
He is not that savvy to put that together.
Right. Well, I mean, I will say Erdogan is now calling the EU's bluff because he's saying, don't say boo about what I'm doing in Syria, or I'm going to, you know, how I was like not letting all those people flood across my border into, you know, into the Schengen, whatever it's called, the Schengen zone, where they can go anywhere across it. Well, you know, say boo to me, and that's it for you guys. Have some 3 million more refugees to Schengen yourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a serious power player, Erdogan, and is not to be taken lightly. You know, sort of person who, when he thinks it's necessary, will arrest 15,000 people in a night. I mean, this is somebody who, you know, stares power in the face and accepts the obligations and the privileges of it. But I want to get back to this question about the response, the Trump supporter response to this, because there is a crew of people who, of course, will support Trump in any way, shape, or form. Lou Dobbs being sort of like the most prominent, let's say, at the moment. But he is distending. He is pushing the boundaries of this in a way that, I mean, Christine, you suggested maybe the Syria thing would, you know, be harmful to him with the Senate. People are discomfited by playing footsie with, you know, trying to get Ukraine and China to investigate his political rivals. People are discomfited by this bug out or whatever it is you want to call it. And, you know, what he does is demand of them some kind of support that starts getting increasingly science fictional. So now we can move into point two of the podcast, which is, you know, whatever's going on with impeachment. So the big thing this week was the release of this letter by White House counsel Pat Cipollone, in which he basically said, screw you, House, we are treating this as though what you're doing is illegitimate, and we're going to make this as hard for you as possible, using, even though I am deeply sympathetic to the notion that the House's effort to get its hands on internal White House documents is a real violation of the separation of powers. But the arguments that he's making that, you know, okay, first you have to have a public vote for impeachment, and then you have to grant everybody subpoena power. And then you can do that. If you don't do that, then we're just not going to cooperate with you. Using the precedents of two impeachment proceedings, one that did not lead to impeachment, which was Nixon, and the other which led to an unsuccessful effort to remove Bill Clinton from office, that they did it this way, so you have to do it that way, because these are, well, two precedents does not, you know, it's like there are too few data points to count as precedential.
It's not even a trend.
There's nothing in the Constitution.
That's right. Three is a trend.
There's nothing in the Constitution that delineates how impeachment proceedings, the details of how it should go. There's a lot of latitude given to Congress once it decides to pursue impeachment to do it the way it sees best. He has no constitutional justification for making those claims.
None whatsoever. Or precedent. As I say, if the precedent is one inquiry in 1974 and another one in 1998, the House didn't. In 1998, all the House did basically was take the Starr report and then write articles of impeachment based on what was in the Starr report. It did not do it. Did not have its own. I mean, it had some hearings, but it was not. You know, basically that's all it was. So, since this would involve a new investigation, of course, and some of the investigation, but this is why it ends up being something that is hard to defend, even if you were in listening to me and you want to defend Trump. I mean, some of these things take place in, you know, not in open session because they involve intelligence matters that should not be discussed in open session.
It's all part of a strategy, which Clinton also used, it should be said, to delegitimize the process. But it's funny how bumbling and just how Trump is bungling it. I mean, he basically is making an argument about parliamentary democracy where, you know, he's saying, oh, they have such a small percentage in the House. And this means that but they can't upend the rules because they have such a small majority. It really doesn't matter. You either have the majority or you don't.
It's not that small a majority, by the way.
No, it's not. That's actually the other thing. But it's 30 seats or something. But this delegitimization of institutions that aren't going his way, and I should say it's a tactic the left also uses. You know, they use it with the Supreme Court. They use it as well. But he is using it in an extremely toxic way now with Congress. And that I think, more than anything else, is putting these senators on the spot in a way that honestly is good, because it's time for them to see what he's attempting to do with their originally mediocre support.
I mean, I just don't understand the logic of the Cipollone letter, because the logic is that they believe in the White House that Nancy Pelosi, you know, doesn't really want to impeach, even though now she says she does, or she doesn't really want a full impeachment inquiry, so she is not putting it up for a vote to protect. Okay, but if they call her bluff after a while, so she will put it up for a vote and it will pass. Yeah. They're not voting on the articles of impeachment. They're only voting to open an impeachment inquiry, and then they'll give themselves impeachment. I mean, it's like,
but he doesn't have a
like,
he.
Yeah,
I was going to say it's because he doesn't have a legal strategy. He only has a political strategy.
Right. Now, I believe that is not. I mean, in the end, I think the best defense against a political assault is a
yes.
political assault. And he proved, I mean, we have to say that he proved politically to be, you know, have show real animal cunning in the way he handled the Mueller report, which is that having established this counter plot line about Mueller, and it was actually Hillary that cooperated with the Russians and all of that, and everything Mueller was doing was a witch hunt. The minute that Mueller did not find that he had conspired with Russia, the argument that he made was seen to have, except for people who were obsessively interested in his impeachment, seemed to have been proved. So he is attempting to establish a new alternate set of facts, which is the Democrats are playing dirty. It's dirty, and they're playing dirty, and they're coming up with a system where there's no open examination of witnesses, and they're not voting for an impeachment inquiry. And there are enough people maybe who will be kind of gulled by this argument. I mean, I still, by the way, think that, and I've written a column that will be in the New York Post tomorrow about how impeachment is a mistake. I still think it's a mistake. 51% of the country supports it. You need 67% of senators to vote for his removal. The country is nowhere near ready for his removal. It is perfectly acceptable to say, since impeachment is a political process, that it's dumb to dedicate the American political culture to this effort if it has no prospect of ultimate success, particularly when we're going into an election season when this thing will overshadow the effort the Democrats want to make to establish a candidate with enough seriousness, gravitas, and energy and level to compete with Trump in 2020. So having said that, the argument that the Trump people are making is preposterous.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say, though, I mean, I guess this is in keeping with what you're saying. With 51% of the country now being in favor of impeachment, having a White House counsel letter say, well, but the Democrats are going about it the wrong way, is not a terribly strong political move.
Right. I mean, yeah, the strong political move, I guess, maybe. Right. But that's what I'm saying. Like, this can be superseded on Friday by the House changing its tactics. It's sort of like Trump. Right. Trump and the letter, right? Which is that the House said we should impeach Trump because he was refusing to, you know, let us know about the whistleblower report. And then Trump said, here's the whistleblower report. So that element, that leg of the attack on Trump disappeared.
Right.
And Pelosi can make the impeachment inquiry leg disappear by having a vote on the impeachment inquiry. Now, I understand she's protecting 20, you know, she's protecting some congressmen who don't want to have to cast that vote. They would be better served, I'll give them advice, but I mean, they would be better served. She can get up and say, we are establishing an impeachment inquiry. This is not the impeachment. This is the majority of the public believes that we need to look into the question of whether or not these were impeachable acts. And that is what we are going to do. And it will be at the end of the inquiry, we will have facts sufficient to determine whether or not we should impeach. And by saying that, she could lower the temperature a little bit and, you know, calm things down a little bit, maybe, who knows, and make Trump seem more irrational by saying that what she's saying is illegitimate. But she clearly is afraid to do that, but we'll see. I don't know.
I mean, I think it also is worth mentioning that Trump's other tactic of saying, I said what I said because I'm interested in corruption. Yeah, I did it. There's no secret. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not an offense. It's not impeachable. I'm asking countries to help in corruption. That hasn't worked in the public, as evidenced by the numbers.
No, there's a 20-point shift. Yeah. The whole point is that there's been a 20-point shift toward impeachment. And so his arguments so far aren't working to help him.
Right.
And this isn't going to work to help him. I mean, it will work again to provide talking points to Fox and to the talk radio people about what it is that they're supposed to say that says that impeachment is illegitimate.
That's his tactic, I think, in exploiting the Pelosi not bringing it to the floor for a vote situation. Because remember, his political rallying line is that Pelosi isn't really in control of her own party. The squad controls the Democratic Party. So if that's true, then obviously the reason, you know, his claim is the reason she's not bringing this to a vote now is that, you know, her left flank is demanding one thing and her moderates are demanding another. And so she's trying to have it both ways. And so exploiting that does benefit him, but only with the people who are already diehard Trump supporters, I think.
Well, this is, of course, the ultimate question about Trump in 2020 that can only be answered on November 3rd, 2020, which is, does he have a stronger base of support than it appears that the polls make it appear? Does he have the support in the right places to win the Electoral College? And does, you know, like relying on his base and going with the more extreme argument the most extreme set of arguments that he can go with, and then trying to, you know, stand on that ground and then assume that everybody will dislike his rivals enough to push him over the finish line, you know, will that work again? And that's clearly where he's going. And the problem is that there is no way to disprove the negative, which is to say, anytime you say, this isn't working, your base isn't growing, you're at 42% in the polls, yada, yada, yada. They're like, yeah, well, that's what you said in October of 2016 with the Access Hollywood tape. And look, I won. So I won. And people are afraid that he's right. I mean, liberals and people think that he may have some kind of magic power to overcome these, you know, numbers. And the proper response probably is to say, well, you know, there were unique circumstances. You know, the October 28th letter from Comey reopening the email investigation, that something like that, there may be an October Supreme, you're not going to have one like that again. And who knows what would have happened at the election if there hadn't been such a letter. I mean, is there any way to know that you know, those 88,000 Democrats didn't stay home in the three states to get them elected. So, but people, no one knows. So the election is going to be fought uniquely on a theory of the electorate that will only be proved or disproved by the result. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you know, there's no data, masterful data system that is, you know, that is going to prove this right.
Well, and that also explains the kind of massive spend. I think that Trump's campaign is trying to hedge their bets a bit, right? He's going to Minneapolis, I think. I mean, he's going to Minnesota today or tomorrow to talk. They have him scheduled to go to some of the places where maybe his support has been slipping a little bit. But they're also, you know, the ad buy they've done on Facebook with anti-impeachment ads is insane. I mean, it's a huge amount of money they're spending. So there's a kind of carpet bombing effect that they're trying to have on some of the issues like impeachment. But they're doing far less to ensure that any wavering suburban lady voters who might have voted for him in 2016 will do so again in 2020.
I mean, the Minnesota play is interesting because he only lost Minnesota by a point and a half. Minnesota is mm-hmm. the one state in the country, really the one state in the country, that seems to be edging red rather than blue, you know, over the last two or three presidential elections. And making a play for Minnesota, there was always going to be a play for Minnesota because he has to do something to expand the map. Mm-hmm. And Minnesota is the play, whereas Democrats have like four or five places they can really stage an effort to expand the map. Not only the obvious ones, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, but Arizona, and even depending on how much money they raise, Texas. I mean, they have to raise a lot of money, or in Iowa, you know, I don't know. So, Colorado, well, no, Hillary won Colorado, but anyway, so we have a thing where he's, you know, basically anticipating something that he's going to do, which is he's going to spend like $100 million in Minnesota to try to flip Minnesota. Let me stop for a second and talk to you about the toothbrush I used this very morning, Quip toothbrush, where, you know, I was, every quadrant, four parts of my mouth, 30 seconds, wait till the electric buzz kicks off and move down to the next quadrant to have a fresh, clean mouth, and feels great, and the best toothbrush I've ever owned. So what actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power, claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes. Look, if you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits. Quick sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer, that's the 30 seconds per quadrant, guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. It automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months. I got my brush head last week. For clean new bristles right on schedule, the sleek intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount. These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice a day. So look, it starts at just $25. You'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/commentary. This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better. But you have to go to getquip.com/commentary to get your first refill free. So go right now to getquip.com/commentary to get that all done. So Bernie Sanders had a heart attack last week and lied about it for 3 days. People all over the place. Christine, so let's talk about mm-hmm. the anger at Bernie's behavior on parts of the liberals and left.
Right. So there, you know, the argument was that, you know, he had his campaign saying, oh, it's just, you know, I had a heart event. I needed a few stents. And they waited several days until he could, of course, have that healthy, grinning photo op of him leaving the hospital, waving and smiling to admit that it was actually a serious heart attack. What Bernie has done kind of cannily, well, first of all, he tweeted out the tweet sort of thanking people for their good wishes. Of course, ended with a hardcore political message of Medicare for all. You know, I mean, it was classic Bernie. But he threw his wife under the bus and said she just didn't want anyone else to know. You know, we wanted to make sure that, you know, I had left the hospital when we told everybody. Maybe it's true, but there's been a little bit of sour grapes on the part of progressive left folks who think that Hillary Clinton's bout of pneumonia during the 2016 campaign was treated too harshly. You remember there was that video footage of her wobbling and someone needing to grab her arm, and she was kind of opaque in releasing information about her condition, which of course then sparks rumors and innuendo, and thanks to social media, a lot of crazy conspiracy theorizing about her health. Bernie's been a little more transparent, but that I think he's going to suffer for having waited a few days to announce a heart attack. He also then, in his first announcement, said, you know, we might have to scale back a little bit. And then a day later, obviously, he'd been advised to go back. He went, sat down with NBC News and said, oh, no, we're charging forward. It's all great. I'm ready for the debate. I'm ready for it all. So he clearly was worried about a slowdown in fundraising and support if he even hinted that he might not have the physical stamina to continue on the campaign.
So I've already had been in email conversation with liberal friends who made this very point this morning about Hillary and her health and Bernie and his health. And the simple fact of the matter is that they're misremembering. In fact, the media did cover up Hillary's health problems, and it took her days to admit that she had pneumonia. They had never said she had had pneumonia. We all saw her faint into the car. And then they pretended that she didn't faint into the car.
And I still don't really know what that was. I mean,
no, it's so funny, right?
She had some kind of a seizure.
Right.
There's no question that she had a seizure. Right. And we had all this information dating back to 2012, 2013, that she'd had this concussion. She'd fallen down the stairs in her house. She'd banged her head. She wore these weird glasses. Right. And, you know, concussions are, no, as we now know from the NFL, are no joke. My daughter got a concussion in May, and she had not recovered from it for 2 months, and she's 12 years old. I mean, concussions are serious businesses, and Clinton said something, her husband said something about how it was a long recovery and a difficult recovery, something like that. So there was this history of lying about her medical condition that she could have gotten away with had she not had something visibly happen in public. So we have a history of people, and of course, the ultimate history of this is JFK, who was deeply sick. Not only did he have Addison's disease, he also had this terrible back problems. He was a drug addict. He was addicted to painkillers. And these were weird late 50s, early 60s painkillers that had hallucinatory effects on people and were really,
old
really
school.
Serious. And there was an entire phalanx of defense against the public knowing anything about how serious his condition was, which I think was the trigger for this whole notion that you had to release your medical records. No one ever made these demands of people until the 70s and 80s. And we did find out, you know, people have had these experiences. So my view of the Sanders thing is he's going to drop out, that he will drop out. I don't know whether it'll be in a week or if it'll be a month. It's not so easy for him to drop out because of the nature of these modern, and by what I mean modern, I mean like the last 7 or 8 years campaigns where he's raised hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, this is a huge operation. This is like a startup. You know, he's probably got hundreds, if not 1,000 people working for him all over the place. And the minute that he says he's no longer a candidate, they're out of work and that's it. It cuts off. Maybe his people are standing around saying, we got to help our people get jobs before they lose all, you know, they lose everything. Or, you know, maybe they'll want to move over to Warren, or they'll want to go work for Andrew Yang or something like that. Or how are we going to handle this? My guess is there's more of this going on inside Sanders' world, which has been a multi-billion dollar operation since 2015. Remember, he raised $250 million in hard money in 2016. And then he kept going. Like, he had 2017, 2018, and now 2019, probably closing in on a billion dollars, and he spends a lot of it, which means he's employing a lot of people and they're doing a lot of stuff that we don't know is going on. He just raised $25 million in the last quarter. So maybe he's got to be convinced he cannot possibly win a single state as somebody who had a significant heart attack in October of 2019. It's not rational. It won't happen. You know, one cough on stage and he's and people rush over and hand him a glass of water. I mean, if you saw him standing on the lawn outside that hospital, he was bright red, like he did not look good. No. And you know, there's a debate on Tuesday night that he apparently is going to be in, and you know, half of the drama was supposed to be Biden versus Warren. Warren and Biden are now tied in the Real Clear Politics average, and half of it's going to be people watching to see if Bernie collapses on stage.
No, they're going to like play Staying Alive as he walks out on the stage. It's just really, but this election more than any other in a very long time highlights this issue of the candidates' mortality. They're all pretty old. Trump is old. I mean, their health should be front and center in voters' minds when they think about the demands of both winning an election in the first place and then governing. So, and we all know, you know, you see those pictures of presidents when they leave office, and you know they look 20 years older, even if they've only been there 8 years. So, Trump is the only person of whom.
That cannot be said. He does not.
Well, it's that executive time that must be like keeping him.
Yeah. But there is a version of the sort of sick watch audience with Trump too. Like, is he he's doing weird things with his mouth?
Mental health.
He looked like he was falling asleep at the UN General Assembly.
Right.
You know, what's going on with him? He has no energy. What's the story here?
But these have become this crazily diagnostic events. You know, now we look at Biden's eye, we look at Bernie's pallor, we watch Trump's speech.
If any of the non-old people had gotten any purchase in the Democratic there could be a real open discussion of this. But every time, you know, two different people tried to do it, and with uncommonly punky results, right? Eric Swalwell did it to Biden, and then Castro did it to Biden. I said Castro because I can never remember whether it's Joaquin or Julian.
Is it Joaquin?
I can't remember. I can't remember which ones. I'm just going to go with candidate Castro. You know, did the, you know, you forgot what you said 2 minutes ago thing. But, you know, if somebody actually were able to say, you know, the problem here is old thinking and we need, you know, Democrats do tend to like younger candidates, you know, Clinton Gore.
Yeah.
Clinton, Gore, Obama, even Dukakis was in his early 50s, I think. I mean, not Mondale, but anyway. So I think that we will see his departure from the race. The question is, will it happen in a way that makes Warren totally inevitable or not? And that's where Biden's age stuff starts kicking in, whether he can make a creditable showing of himself. I still don't think that it's age that is responsible for the things that people think are, you know, bad about him. That's him.
You know, I just want to say, though, I think there's some chance that Bernie, given who he is, his story, the place he's arrived at this point, there might be some thinking on his part that's just like, well, I'm just going to keep going until I drop. This is not going to end.
He is stubborn.
Or if it ends, it ends on the way.
Yeah, there's this other just dreadful fact, which is that his daughter-in-law died
terrible.
On Monday of cancer at the age of 46. Yeah. I mean, you know, at the age of 46, like, that's a family, you know, that's like dropping a nuclear bomb into a family.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows what effect that will have.
Right.
So that's a terrible, terrible thing. Brings us to the close of this on a proper note of Prussian morosity. So for A. Greenwald and Christine Rosen, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.